She starts chattering, so much that I can't get a word in edgewise. But that's okay, because I'm nervous as I'll get out. I don't have the money for a private lawyer, at least not without liquidating everything I've saved for Edison's education, and I would go to prison for life before I let that happen. Still, just because everyone can have a lawyer in this country doesn't mean all lawyers are the same. On TV, the people who have private attorneys get acquitted, and the ones with public defenders pretend that there isn't a difference. Ms. McQuarrie suggests we go somewhere for lunch, even though I'm too anxious to eat. I start to take out my wallet after we order, but she insists on paying. At first, I bristle. Ever since I was little and started wearing Christina's hand-me-downs, I haven't wanted to be someone's charity case. But before I can complain, I check myself. What if she does this with all her clients just to build up rapport? What if she's trying to make me like her as much as I want her to like me? After we sit down with our trays, out of habit, I say grace. Mind you, I'm used to doing that when other people don't. Corinne's an atheist who's always joking about the spaghetti monster in the sky when she hears me pray or sees me bow my head over my bag lunch. So I'm not surprised when I find Ms. McQuarrie staring at me as I finish. "So you're a churchgoer?" she says. "Is that a problem?" Maybe she knows something I don't, like that juries are more likely to convict people who believe in God. "Not at all. In fact, it's good to know, because it's something that can help a jury like you." Hearing her say that, I look into my lap. Am I so naturally unlikable that she needs to find things that will sway people in my favor? "First," she says, "do you prefer the term black or African-American or people of color?" What I prefer, I think, is Ruth. But I swallow my response and say, "People of color." Once at work, an orderly named Dave went off on a rant about that term. "It's not like I don't have color," he'd said, holding out his pasty arms. "I'm not see-through, right?" But I guess people of more color hasn't caught on. Then he had noticed me in the break room and had gone red to his hairline. "Sorry, Ruth, but you know I hardly think of you as black." My lawyer is still talking. "I don't even see color," she tells me. "I mean, the only race that matters is the human one, right?" It's easy to believe we are all in this together when you're not the one who was dragged out of your home by the police. But I know that when white people say things like that, they are doing it because they think it's the right thing to say, not because they realize how glib they all sound. A couple of years ago, Adisa went ballistic when the hashtag All Lives Matter took over Twitter as a response to the activists who were holding signs that said Black Lives Matter. "What they're really saying is White Lives Matter," Adisa told me, "and that black folks better remember that before we get too bold for our own good." Ms. McQuarrie coughs lightly, and I realize my mind's been wandering. I force my eyes to her face, smile tightly. "Remind me again where you went to school," she asks. I feel like this is a test. "SUNY Plattsburgh, and then to Yale Nursing School." "Impressive." "What is? That I'm college educated? That I went to Yale? Is this what Edison will face for the rest of his life, too?" Edison. "Ms. McQuarrie," I begin. "Kennedy." "Kennedy." The familiarity sits uncomfortably on my tongue. "I can't go back to prison. I think of how, when Edison was a toddler, he'd put on Wesley's shoes and shuffle around in them. Edison will have a lifetime to see the magic he used to believe in as a child be methodically erased one confrontation at a time. I don't want him to have to face that any sooner than necessary. I've got my boy, and there's no one else who can raise him to be the man I know he's going to be." Ms. McQuarrie, Kennedy, leans forward. "I'm going to do my best. I have a lot of experience in cases with people like you." Another label. "People like me? People accused of serious crimes." Immediately, I am on the defensive. "But I didn't do anything." "I believe you. However, we still have to convince a jury. So we have to go back to the basics to figure out why you've been charged." I look at her carefully, trying to give her the benefit of the doubt. This is the only case on my radar, but maybe she's juggling hundreds. Maybe she honestly has forgotten the skinhead with the tattoo who spit on me in the courtroom. I think that's pretty obvious. The baby's father didn't want me near his son. The white supremacist? He has nothing to do with your case. For a moment, I'm speechless. I was removed from the care of a patient because of the color of my skin, and then penalized for following those directions when the same patient went into distress. How on earth could the two not be related? But I'm the only nurse of color on the birthing pavilion. To the state, it doesn't matter if you're black or white or blue or green, Kennedy explains. To them, you had a legal duty to take care of an infant under your charge. She starts listing all the ways the jury can find a reason to convict me. Each feels like a brick being mortared into place, trapping me in this hole. I realize that I have made a grave mistake. I had assumed that justice was truly just, that jurors would assume I was innocent until proven guilty. But prejudice is exactly the opposite, judging before the evidence exists. I don't stand a chance. Do you really believe that if I was white, I say quietly, I'd be sitting here with you right now? She shakes her head. No, I believe it's too risky to bring up in court. So we are supposed to win a case by pretending the reason it happened doesn't exist? It seems dishonest, oblivious. Like saying a patient died of an infected hangnail without mentioning that he had type 1 diabetes. If no one ever talks about race in court, I say, how is anything ever supposed to change? She folds her hand on the table between us. You file a civil lawsuit. I can't do it for you, but I can call around and find you someone who works with employment discrimination. She explains in legalese what that means for me. The damages she mentions are more than I ever imagined in my wildest dreams. But there's a catch. There's always a catch. The lawsuit that might net me this payout, that might help me hire a private lawyer who might actually be willing to admit that race is what landed me in court in the first place, can't be filed until this lawsuit wraps up. In other words, if I'm found guilty now, I can kiss that future money goodbye. Suddenly I realize that Kennedy's refusal to mention race in court may not be ignorant. It's the very opposite. It's because she is aware of exactly what I have to do in order to get what I deserve. I might as well be blind and lost, and Kennedy McQuarrie is the only one with a map. So I look her in the eye. What do you want to know? I say.
Kennedy. When I come home the night after my first meeting with Ruth, Micah is working late and my mother is watching Violet. The house smells of oregano and freshly baked dough. Is it my lucky day? I call out, shuffling off the heaviness of my job, as Violet gets up from the table where she's coloring and makes a beeline for me. Is there homemade pizza for dinner? I swing my daughter up in my arms. She is clutching a violent red crayon in one small fist.
I made you one. Guess what it is?
My mother comes out of the kitchen holding an amoebic blob on a plate. Oh, clearly it's an alien. I catch my mother's eye and she shakes her head. Behind Violet's back, she puts her hands up and bares her teeth. Dinosaur, I correct. I mean, obviously. Violet smiles widely.
But he's sick,
she points to the oregano spotting the cheese.
That's why he has a rash.
Is it chicken pox? I ask as I take a bite.
No, she says. He has a reptile dysfunction.
I nearly spit out the pizza. Immediately, I drop Violet to her feet. As she runs back to the table to continue coloring, I raise a brow. What were you watching? I calmly ask my mother. She knows that the only television we let Violet watch is Sesame Street or Disney Junior. But from the studied wash of innocence on my mother's face, I know she's hiding something. Nothing. I pivot, staring at the blank TV screen. On a hunch, I pick the remote up from the couch and turn it on. Wallace Mercy is grandstanding in all his glory outside City Hall in Manhattan. His wild white hair stands on end, like he's been electrocuted. His fist is raised in solidarity with whatever apparent injustice he's currently championing.
My brothers and sisters, I ask you, when did the word misunderstanding become synonymous with racial profiling? We demand an apology from the New York City Police Commissioner for the shame and inconvenience suffered by this celebrated athlete.
The Fox News logo runs beneath the slightly familiar face of a handsome, dark-skinned man. Fox News, a channel that Micah and I do not generally watch. A channel that would easily be the home of multiple ads about erectile dysfunction. You let Violet watch this?
Of course not,
my mother says. I just turned it on during her nap time. Violet looks up from her coloring.
The five-o-meter.
I shoot my mother the look of death. You're watching The Five with my four-year-old daughter. She throws up her hands.
All right, fine. Yes, sometimes I do. It's the news, for goodness sake. It's not like I'm putting on P-O-R-N.
Besides, did you even hear about this? It's a simple misunderstanding. And that ridiculous fake reverend is shooting his mouth off again, all because the police were trying to do their job. I look at Violet.
Honey, I say, why don't you go pick out the pajamas you want to wear and $2 for bedtime?
She runs upstairs, and I turn back to the television. If you want to watch Wallace Mercy, at least put on MSNBC. I say.
I don't want to watch Wallace. In fact, I don't think he's doing Malik Thedone any good by taking on his cause.
Malik Thedone. That's why he looks familiar. He won the U.S. Open a few years back.
What happened?
He walked out of his hotel and was grabbed by four policemen. Apparently, it was a case of mistaken identity. Ava settles beside me on the couch as the camera zooms in on Wallace Mercy's verbal tantrum. The cords in his neck stand out, and there is a throbbing vein at his temple. This man is a heart attack waiting to happen.
You know, my mother says, if they weren't so angry all the time, maybe more people would listen to them.
I don't have to ask who they are. I take another bite of my dinosaur pizza. How about we go back to only turning the television on to a channel that doesn't have commercials with side effects? My mother folds her arms.
I would think, of all people, you'd want your child to be a student of the world, Kennedy.
She's a baby, Mom. Violet doesn't need to think that the police might grab her one day.
Oh, please.
Violet was coloring. All that went right over her head. The only thing she even remarked on was Wallace Mercy's extremely poor choice of hairdo. I press my fingers to the corners of my eyes. Okay, I'm tired. Let's just table this conversation. My mother takes my empty plate and stands up, clearly miffed.
Far be it from me to see myself as more than just the hired help.
She disappears into the kitchen, and I go to put Vi to bed. She has picked a book about a mouse with a mouthful of a name none of her friends can pronounce, and Go Dog Go, which is the title I hate more than anything else in her library. I climb into bed with her and drop a kiss on the crown of her head. She smells like strawberry bubble bath and Johnson shampoo, exactly like my own childhood. As I start to read aloud, I make a mental note to thank my mother for bathing Violet and feeding her, and loving her as fiercely as I do, even if she did expose her to Wallace Mercy's righteous wrath. In that moment, my mind drifts to Ruth. Violet doesn't need to think that the police might grab her one day, I had said to my mother. But honestly, the odds of my child being a victim of mistaken identity are considerably smaller than, say, Ruth's.
Mommy!
Violet demands. And I realize I've inadvertently stopped reading, lost in thought. Do you like my hat? I read aloud. I do not.
Ruth.
Adisa says I need to treat myself, so she offers to buy me lunch. We go to a little bistro that bakes its own bread, and that serves portions so large you always wind up taking home half. It's busy, so Adisa and I sit at the bar. I have been spending more time with my sister, which is both comforting and strange. Before, I was almost always working when I wasn't with Edison. Now my schedule is empty. This is nice and all, Adisa says to me, but have you given any thought to how you're going to pay for your own lunch down the road? I think about what Kennedy said yesterday about filing a civil suit. It's money, but it's money I cannot count on yet. Maybe never. I'm a little more concerned with feeding my son, I admit. She narrows her glance. How much cushion you have? There's no point in lying to her. About 3 months. You know, if things get tight, you can ask me for help, right? At that, I can't help but smile. Seriously? I had to give you a loan last month. Adisa grins. I said you can ask me for help. I didn't say I'd be able to provide it. She shrugs. Besides, you know there's an answer. What I have learned this week is that I'm overqualified for nearly every entry-level administrative job in New Haven, including all open secretarial and receptionist positions. My sister believes I should file for unemployment, but I see that as dishonest, since once this is settled, I plan to go back to work. Getting a part-time job is another alternative, but I'm qualified as a nurse, and my license is suspended. So instead, I've avoided the conversation. All I know is that when Tiana's boyfriend got busted for larceny and went to trial, the court date wasn't for 8 months, Adisa says, which puts you 5 months in the hole. What advice did that skinny white lawyer give you? Her name is Kennedy, and we were too busy trying to figure out how I won't go to prison to discuss how I can support myself while I'm waiting for a trial date. Adisa snorts. Yeah, because that kind of detail probably never occurs to someone like her. You met her once, I point out. You know nothing about her. I know that people who become public defenders are doing it because morals are more important to them than money, or else they would be off making partner in the big city. Which means Ms. Kennedy either has a trust fund or a sugar daddy. She got me out on bail. Correction. Your son got you out on bail. I shoot Adisa a glare and turn my attention to the bartender who is polishing glasses. Adisa rolls her eyes. You don't want to talk, that's fine. She looks up at the television over the bar, on which an infomercial is playing. Hey, she says to the bartender, can we watch something else? Be my guest, he says, and hands her a remote control. A minute later, Adisa is flipping through the cable stations. She stops when she hears a familiar gospel jingle. Lord, 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 have mercy. And then the camera cuts tight to Wallace Mercy, the activist. Today, he is lambasting a Texas school district that had a young Muslim boy arrested after he brought a homemade clock to school to show his science teacher, and it was mistakenly identified as a bomb. Ahmed, Wallace says, if you are listening, I want to tell you something. I want to say to all the black and brown children out there who are afraid that they too might be misunderstood because of the color of their skin. I am pretty sure Wallace Mercy used to be a preacher, but I don't think he ever got the memo that said he doesn't need to shout when he's mic'd on a television set. I want to say that I, too, was once thought to be less than I was because of how I looked. And I'm not going to lie. Sometimes when the devil is whispering doubt into my ear, I still think those people were right. But most of the time, I think I have shown all of the bullies up. I have succeeded in spite of them. And so will you. Adisa gasps. Oh my God, Ruth, that's what you need. Wallace Mercy. I am 100% sure that Wallace Mercy is the last thing I need. What are you talking about? Your story is exactly what he lives for. Job discrimination because of race? He'll eat it up. He'll make sure everyone in the country knows you were wronged. On the television, Wallace is shaking a fist. Does he have to be so mad all the time? Adisa laughs. Well, hell, girl, I'm mad all the time. I'm exhausted just from being black all day, she says. At least he gives people like us a voice. A loud one. Exactly. Damn, Ruth, you've been drinking the Kool-Aid. You've been swimming with the sharks for so long, you've forgotten your krill. What? Don't sharks eat krill? They eat people. This is what I'm telling you, Adisa sighs. White folks have spent years giving black folks their freedom on paper, but deep down they still expect us to say yes, massa, and be quiet and grateful for what we got. If we speak our minds, we can lose our jobs, our homes, even our lives. Wallace is the man who gets to be angry for us. If it weren't for him, white folks would never know the stupid shit they do upsets us, and black folks would get madder and madder because they can't risk talking back. Wallace Mercy is what keeps the powder keg in this country from blowing up. Well, that's all very well and good, but I'm not on trial because I'm black. I'm on trial because a baby died when I was on duty. Adisa smirks. Who told you that? Your lily white lawyer? Of course she don't think this is about race. She don't think about race, period. She don't have to. Okay, well, when you get your law degree, you can advise me about the case. Until then, I'm going to take her word for it. I hesitate. You know, for someone who hates being stereotyped, you sure as hell do it a lot yourself. My sister holds up her hands, a surrender. Okay, Ruth, you're right, I'm wrong. I'm just saying, so far, Kennedy McQuarrie is doing her job. Her job is to rescue you so she can feel good about herself, Adisa says. It's called White Knight for a reason. She narrows her gaze at me. And you know what's on the other end of that color spectrum. I don't give her the satisfaction of a response, but we both know the answer. Black. The color of the villain. I have only been to Christina's Manhattan home once, just after she married Larry Sawyer. It was to drop off a wedding gift, and the whole experience had been awkward. Christina and Larry had a destination wedding in Turks and Caicos, and Christina had said over and over how sorry she was that she couldn't invite all of her friends down there, but instead had to limit the guest list. When she opened my present, a set of linen tea towels, screen-printed with the handwritten recipes of my mother's cookies and cakes and pies she loved most, she burst into tears and hugged me, saying that it was the most personal, thoughtful gift she'd received, and that she would use them every day. Now, more than 10 years later, I wonder if she ever used her kitchen, much less the tea towels. The granite countertops gleam, and in a blue glass bowl there are fresh apples that look like they've been polished. There is no evidence that a 4-year-old lives anywhere nearby. I have an itch to open the double Viking oven just to see if there's a single crumb or grease stain. Please, Christina says, gesturing to one of the kitchen chairs, sit. I do, startled to find that there is soft music coming out of the wall behind me. It's a speaker, she says, laughing at my face. It's hidden. I wonder what it would be like to live in a place that feels like it is constantly part of a photo shoot. The Christina I used to know left a trail of destruction from the foyer to the kitchen the moment she came home from school, dropping her coat and book bag and kicking off her shoes. Just then, a woman appears so silently she might as well have emerged from the wall as well. She sets a plate of chicken salad down in front of me and one in front of Christina. Thanks, Rosa, Christina says, and I realize that she probably still drops her coat and her bags and her shoes when she comes into her house. But Rosa is her Lou. It's just a different person now who is picking up after her. The maid slips away again, and Christina starts talking about a hospital fundraiser and how Bradley Cooper agreed to come and then backed out at the last minute because of strep throat. And then Us Weekly photographed him the same night in a dive bar in Chelsea with his girlfriend. She is chattering so much about a topic I care nothing about that before I even finish half my salad, I realize why she's invited me here. So, I interrupt, did you hear about it from my mom? Her face falls. No, Larry. Now that he's filed the paperwork to run for office, we have the news on 24/7. She bites her lip. Was it awful? A laugh bubbles up in my throat. What part of it? Well, all of it. Getting fired? Being arrested? Her eyes grow wide. Did you have to go to jail? Was it like Orange is the New Black? Yeah, without the sex, I look at her. It wasn't my fault, Christina. You have to believe me. She reaches across the table and grabs my hand. I do, Ruth. I hope you know that. I wanted to help you, you know. I told Larry to hire someone from his old firm to represent you. I freeze. I try to see this as a gesture of friendship, but it feels like I'm a problem to solve. I couldn't accept that. Well, before you go thinking I'm your fairy godmother, Larry shot me down. He feels as badly as I do, honestly, but with his candidacy, it's just not a good time to be connected to something scandalous. Scandalous. I taste the word. Bite into it like a berry, feeling it burst. We had a huge fight about it. I mean, like, I made him move into the second bedroom and everything. It's not like he's going for the neo-Nazi vote, but it's not that simple, I guess. Race relations are a mess right now, with the police commissioner under fire and everything, and Larry needs to stay as far away from that as possible, or it could cost him the election. She shakes her head. I'm so sorry, Ruth. My jaw feels too tight. Is this why you had me over here? I ask. To tell me you can't be associated with me anymore? What had I been stupid enough to think? That this was a social visit? That for the first time in a decade, Christina had suddenly decided she wanted me to drop in for lunch? Or had I known all along that if I came here, it was because I was hoping for a miracle in the form of the Hollowells, even if I was too proud to admit it? For a long moment, we just stare at each other. No, Christina says. I needed to see you with my own eyes. I wanted to make sure you were, you know, all right. Pride is an evil dragon. It sleeps underneath your heart, and then roars when you need silence. Well, you can check this off your good deed list, I say bitterly. I'm doing just fine. Ruth, I hold up my hand. Don't, Christina, okay? Just don't. I try to feel through the chain of our history for the snag, the mend in the links, where we went from being two girls who knew everything about each other. Favorite ice cream flavor, favorite new kids on the block member, celebrity crush, to two women who knew nothing about how the other lived. Had we drifted apart, or had our closeness been the ruse? Was our familiarity due to friendship or geography? I'm sorry, Christina says, her voice tiny. I am too, I whisper. Suddenly she bolts from the table and comes back a moment later. Emptying the contents of her bag. Sunglasses and keys and lipsticks and receipts scatter the surface of the table. Advil tablets, loose in the bottom of her bag, spill like candy. She opens her wallet and takes a thick wad of bills and presses it into my hand. Take this, Christina says, just between the two of us. When our hands brush, there is an electric shock. I jump up, as if it were a bolt of lightning. No! I say, backing away. This is a line, and if I cross it, everything changes between Christina and me. Maybe we have never been equals, but at least I have been able to pretend. If I take this money, I can't go on fooling myself. I can't. Christina is fierce, folding my fingers around the money. Just do it, she says. Then she looks up at me as if all is well in the world, as if nothing has changed. As if I have not just become a beggar at her feet, a charity, a cause. There's dessert, Christina says. Rosa? I trip over my chair in my hurry to escape. I'm not really very hungry, I avert my glance. I have to go. I grab my coat and my purse from the rack in the foyer and hurry out the door, closing it tight behind me. I push the elevator button over and over as if that might make it come faster. And I count the bills. $556. The elevator dings. I hurry toward the welcome mat outside Christina's door and slip all of the money beneath it. This morning I told Edison we couldn't drive the car anymore. The registration has expired and I can't afford to renew it. Selling it will be my last resort, but in the meantime, while I try to save enough to cover the state and federal fees and the gas, we will take the bus. I get into the elevator and close my eyes until I reach ground level. I run down Central Park West until I cannot catch my breath, until I know I will not change my mind. The building on Humphrey Street looks like any other government building. A square, cement, bureaucratic block. The welfare office is packed, every cracked plastic seat filled with someone who has bent over a clipboard. Adisa walks me up to the counter. She's working now, making minimum wage as a part-time cashier, but she's been in and out of this office a half a dozen times when she was between jobs and knows the ropes. My sister needs to apply for assistance, she announces, as if the statement doesn't make me die a little inside. The secretary looks to be Edison's age. She has long, swinging earrings shaped like tacos. Fill this out, she says, and she hands me a clipboard with an application. Since there is nowhere to sit, we lean against the wall. While Adisa searches for a pen in her cavernous shoulder bag, I glance at the women balancing clipboards and toddlers on their knees, at the men who reek of booze and sweat, at a woman with a long gray braid who is holding a doll and singing to herself. About half the room is Caucasian, mothers wiping the noses of their children in wads of tissues, and nervous men in collared shirts who tap their pens against their legs as they read each line on the form. Adisa sees me glancing at them. 2/3 of welfare goes to white folks, she says. Go figure. I have never been so grateful for my sister. I fill out the first few queries. Name, address, number of dependents. Income, I read. I start to put down my annual salary and then cross it out. Write $0, Adisa says. I get a little bit from Wesley's. Write $0, Adisa repeats. I know people who got rejected for SNAP because they had cars that were worth too much. You're going to screw the system the way the system screwed you. When I don't start writing, she takes the application, fills in the blanks, and returns it to the secretary. An hour passes, and not a single person is called from the waiting room. How long does this take, I whisper to my sister. However long they feel like making you wait, Adisa replies. Half the reason these people can't get a job is because they're too busy sitting here waiting on benefits to go apply anywhere. It's nearly 3 o'clock, 4 hours after we arrived, before a caseworker comes to the door. Ruby Jefferson, she says. I stand up. Ruth. She glances at the paperwork. Maybe, she concedes. Adisa and I follow her down a hallway to a cubicle and sit. I'm going to ask you some questions, she says in monotone. Are you still employed? It's complicated. I was suspended. What's that mean? I'm a nurse, but my license has been put on hold until an impending lawsuit is over. I say these words in a rush, like they are being purged from the core of me. It don't matter, Adisa says. I'm going to break it down for you. She don't got no job, and she don't got no money. I stare at my sister. I had been hoping that maybe the caseworker and I could find some common ground, that she might recognize me not as a typical governmental assistance applicant, but as someone middle class who has gotten a bum deal. Adisa, on the other hand, has whipped out the Ebonics, pushing as far away from my tactic as possible. The caseworker shoves her glasses up her nose. What about your son's college fund? It's a 529, I say. You can only use it for education. She need medical, Adisa interrupts. The woman glances at me. What are you paying right now for Cobra? $1,100 a month, I answer, flushing. But I won't be able to afford that by next month. The woman nods, noncommittal. Get rid of your Cobra payment. You qualify for Obamacare. Oh, no, you don't understand. I don't want to get rid of my coverage. I just want to get temporary funding, I explain. That's the health insurance that comes from the hospital. I'm going to get my job back eventually. Adisa rounds on me. And in the meantime, what if Edison breaks his leg? Adisa, you think you O.J. Simpson? You gonna get off and walk away? Newsflash, Ruth, you ain't O.J. You for sure ain't Oprah. You ain't Kerry Washington. They get passes from white people because they famous. You just another nigga who's going down. I'm sure that the caseworker can see the steam rising from my hair. My fingers are clenched so tightly into fists that I can feel myself drawing blood. I'm not quite sure what precipitated this transformation into full-on gangster, but I'm going to kill my sister. Hell, I've already been indicted for homicide. The caseworker glances from Adisa to me and then down to the paperwork. She clears her throat. Well, she says, all too happy to get rid of us, you qualify for medical, SNAP, and cash assistance. You'll be hearing from us. Adisa hooks her arm through mine and pulls me up from my chair. Thank you, I murmur, as my sister drags me from the cubicle. Now, that wasn't so bad, was it? She says when we are out of earshot, standing next to a potted plant near the elevator bank. She is suddenly back to her normal self. I round on her. What the hell was that? You were a total asshole. An asshole who got you the money you need, Adisa points out. You can thank me later. My trainer is a girl named Nandi, and I am old enough to be her mother. So basically there are 5 stations, she tells me. Cashier, headset, coffee headset, presenter, and runner. I mean, there are people on table too, of course. They're the ones who are making the food. I trail her, tugging at my uniform, which has an itchy tag at the neck. I'm working an 8-hour shift, which means I get a 30-minute break and a free meal and minimum wage. After exhausting all temp agency office job positions, I'd applied to McDonald's. I said I'd taken time off from work to be a mom. I didn't even mention the word nurse. I just wanted to be hired so that I could give up some of the benefits I'd received at the unemployment office. For my own sanity, I needed to believe that I could still, at least in part, take care of myself and my son. When the manager called to offer me the job, he asked if I could start immediately since they were short-staffed. So I left a note for Edison on the kitchen counter saying I had a surprise for him and caught a bus downtown. The fry hopper is where the fries are loaded. There are 3 basket sizes to use, depending on how busy we are, Nandi says. There's a timer here you have to push when you drop the basket. But at 2:40, you need to shake it so the fries don't become one giant blob, okay? I nod, watching the line worker, a college student named Mike, do everything she is saying. Once the timer goes off, you hold the basket over the vat and let the oil drain for about 10 seconds, and then dump them into the fry station. Watch out, that's hot. And salt them. Unless it's a no-salt fry order, Mike says. We'll worry about that later, Nandi replies. The salt dispenser puts the same amount on every batch. Then you toss with the fry scoop and press a timer. All those fries need to be sold in 5 minutes, and if they're not, they get dumped out. I nod. It's a lot to process. I had 1,000 things to remember as a nurse, but after 20 years, that was muscle memory. This is all new. Mike lets me try the fry station. I'm surprised at how heavy the basket is when it's dripping. My hands are slippery in their plastic gloves. I can feel the oil settling through my hairnet. That's great, Nandi says. I learn how to bag properly, how many minutes each food item can sit in the warming basket before being discarded, which cleaners are used on which surfaces, how to tell the manager you need more quarters, how to push the medium-sized button on the register before you push the button for number 1 meal, or else the customer won't get fries with his order. Nandi has the patience of a saint when I forget ranch dipping sauce or grab a McDouble instead of a double cheeseburger. They're identical except for 1 extra slice of cheese. She feels confident enough after an hour to put me on table, assembling the food. I have never been one to shy away from scut work. God knows in nursing you have your share of holding emesis basins and changing soiled sheets. What I always would tell myself was that after an episode like that, the patient was even more uncomfortable, physically or emotionally or both, than I was. My job was to make things better as professionally as possible. So getting a job as a fast food worker really doesn't bother me. I'm not here for the glory. I'm here for the paycheck, as meager as it might be. I take a deep breath and grab the 3-part bun and set the pieces in their spots in the toaster. Meanwhile, I open a Big Mac box. This is easier said than done while wearing plastic gloves. The top part of the bun is sesame seed down in the top of the box. The middle piece sits balanced on the top of that. The bottom part is bottom side down in the bottom half of the box. 2 squirts of Big Mac sauce from the giant metal sauce gun go on each side. Shredded lettuce and minced onions are sprinkled on top of that. The middle piece gets 2 strategically located pickles. They should be dating, not mating, said Nandi. The bottom gets a slice of American cheese. Then I reach into the warmer for 2 10-to-1 patties and place 1 on the top and one on the bottom. Lift the middle piece and place on the bottom part. Place the top of the bun on that, and the box is closed and given to a runner for bagging or counter service. It's not delivering a baby, but I feel the same flush of a job well done. 6 hours into my shift, my feet hurt and I reek of oil. I've cleaned the bathrooms twice, including once after a four-year-old got sick all over the floor. I've just started working as a runner to Nandi's cashier when a woman orders a 20-piece McNuggets. I check the box myself before putting it on the tray, and like I've been taught, I call her order number and tell her to have a nice day as I'm handing it over. She sits down 10 feet away from me and eats every last piece of chicken. Then suddenly she is back at the counter. "This box was empty," she tells Nandi. "I paid for nothing." "I'm so sorry," Nandi says. "We'll get you a new one." I sidle closer, lowering my voice. "I checked that box myself. I watched her eat all 20 of those nuggets." "I know," Nandi whispers back. "She does this all the time."
The manager on duty, a cadaverous man with a soul patch, approaches.
"Everything all right here?"
"Just fine," Nandi says.
She takes a new box of nuggets out of my hand and passes it to the customer, who carries it out to the parking lot. The manager goes back to the presenter position, handing out food at the drive-thru.
"You've got to be kidding me," I mutter. "If you let it get under your skin, you won't make it through a single shift."
Nandi turns her attention toward a high-spirited group of kids who surf through the door on the wave of their own laughter.
"After-school rush," she warns. "Get your game face on."
I turn back to the screen, waiting for the next order to magically appear.
"Welcome to McDonald's," Nandi says. "Can I take your order?"
I hope it's not a shake. That's the one machine I don't feel confident running yet. And Nandi already told me a story about how her first week, she forgot to put in the pins and the milk exploded all over her and onto the floor.
"I'll take a Big Mac meal," I hear. "Dude, what do you want?"
"I left my wallet at home." I spin around because I know that voice. Standing in front of the counter is Edison's friend, Bryce. And beside him, hands jammed into the pockets of his jacket, is my son. I can see the absolute horror in Edison's eyes as he scans my hairnet, my uniform, my new life. So instead of smiling at him or saying hello, I turn my back again before Bryce can recognize me too, before I have to hear Edison make yet another excuse for the situation I've put him in. Edison is not home when I arrive, strip off my uniform, and shower away the smell of grease. I text him, but he doesn't answer. So instead, I cook dinner, pretending that nothing is wrong. By the time he finally comes home, I have just put the casserole on the table. "It's hot," I tell him, but he goes straight to his bedroom. I think he is still upset about my new job, but moments later he appears, holding a giant mason jar full of coins, as well as a checkbook. He tosses these on the table.
2,386, Edison announces, and there's got to be a couple of hundred more in the jar.
"That's money for college," I say.
"We need it now. I've got the whole spring and summer to work. I can make more."
I know how scrupulously Edison has saved his earnings from the grocery store where he's worked since he was 16. It was always understood that he'd chip in for his education, and between scholarships and FAFSA and the 529 plan we started for him as a baby, I would swing the rest of the tuition. The thought of taking money that is earmarked for college makes me feel sick. "Edison, no." His face crumples.
"Mama, I can't. I can't let you work at McDonald's when I have money we could use. You got any idea how that makes me feel?"
"First, that isn't money. That's your future. Second, there's no shame in a good, honest day's work, even if it's making French fries." I squeeze his hand.
"And it's only for a little while, till this is all cleared up and I can work at the hospital again. If I drop track, I can get more shifts at the Stop and Shop."
"You're not dropping track. I don't care about that dumb sport. And I don't care about anything but you," I tell him. I sit down across from him.
"Baby, let me do this, please."
I feel my eyes fill with tears.
If you asked me who Ruth Jefferson was a month ago, I would have said she's a good nurse and she's a good mother. But now I have people telling me I wasn't a good nurse. And if I can't put a casserole on the table and clothes on your back, then I have to second-guess myself as a mother, too. If you don't let me do this, if you don't let me take care of you, then I don't know who I'm supposed to be anymore.
He folds his arm tight across his chest, looks away from me. Everyone knows. I hear them whispering, and then they stop when I get close. The students? Teachers, too, he admits. I bristle. That's inexcusable.
No, it's not like that. They're going out of their way, you know? Like giving me extra time for papers and saying that they know things are rough at home right now. And every time one of them is like that, so nice and understanding, I feel like I want to hit something. Because it's even worse than when people pretend they don't know you miss school because your mother was in jail. He grimaces. That test I failed? It wasn't because I didn't know the stuff. It was because I cut class after Mr. Herman cornered me and asked if there was anything he could do to help.
Oh, Edison.
I don't want their help, he explodes. I don't want to be someone who needs their help. I just want to be like everyone else, you know, not a special case. And then I get mad at myself because I'm whining like I'm the only one with problems when you might... When you...
He breaks off, rubbing his palms against his knees.
Don't say it, I say, folding him into my arms. Don't even think it. I pull away and frame his beautiful face. We don't need their help. We'll get through this. You believe me, right?
He looks at me, really looks at me, like a pilgrim searches the night sky for meaning.
I don't know.
Well, I do, I say firmly. Now eat what's on your plate, because I'm sure as hell not going to McDonald's if it gets cold.
Edison picks up his fork, grateful for the distraction. And I try not to think about the fact that for the first time in my life, I've lied to my son. A week later, I am rushing around, trying to find my uniform visor, when the doorbell rings. Standing on my porch, to my shock, is Wallace Mercy. Wiry white shock of hair, three-piece suit, pocket watch and all.
Oh my, I say. The words are puffs of breath, dry in the desert of my disbelief.
My sister, he booms. My name is Wallace Mercy.
I giggle. I actually giggle. Because really, who doesn't know that? I glance around to see if he's being followed by an entourage, by cameras. But the only sign of his renown is a sleek black town car pulled up to the curb with its flashers on, and a driver in the front seat. I wonder if I might take a moment of your time. The closest brush with fame I've had is when a late-night TV show host's pregnant wife got into a car accident near the hospital and was put on the ward for 24 hours of monitoring. Although she turned out to be perfectly fine, my role segued from healthcare provider to publicist, holding back the crowd of reporters who threatened to overrun the ward. It figures that now, the only other time in my life I've met a celebrity, I'm wearing a polyester uniform.
Of course, I usher him through the door, silently thanking God that I already made my pull-out bed back into a couch. Can I get you something to drink?
Coffee would be a blessing, he says.
As I turn on the Keurig, I'm thinking that Edisa would die if she were here. I wonder if it would be rude to take a selfie with Wallace Mercy and send it to her.
You have a lovely home, he tells me, and he looks at the photos on my mantle. This your boy? I've heard he's something else.
From whom, I think.
Do you take milk, sugar?
Both, Wallace Mercy says. He takes the mug and gestures to the couch.
May I?
I nod, and he motions so that I will sit down on the chair beside him.
Ms. Jefferson, do you know why I'm here?
Honestly, I can't even quite believe you are here, much less figure out why. He smiles. He has the most even white teeth I have ever seen, stark against the darkness of his skin. I realize that up close, he is younger than I expected.
I have come to tell you that you are not alone.
Confused, I tilt my head. That's very kind, but I already have a pastor. But your community is much bigger than just your church. My sister, this is not the first time our people have been targeted. We may not have the power yet, but what we have is each other. My mouth rounds as I start to put the pieces together. It's like Adisa said. My case is just another apple box for him to stand on, to get noticed. It's very kind of you to come here, but I don't think my story is one that would be particularly interesting to you. On the contrary, may I be so bold as to ask you a question? When you were singled out and asked not to interfere with the care of a white baby, did any of your colleagues come to your defense? I think about Corinne, squirming when I complained about Marie's unjust directive, and then defending Carla Luongo. My friend knew I was upset. Did she go to bat for you? Would she risk her job for you? I would hardly have asked her to do that, I say, getting annoyed. What color skin does your colleague have? Wallace asks bluntly. The fact that I'm black was never an issue in my relationships with my colleagues. Not until they needed a scapegoat. What I am trying to say, Ruth, may I call you that? Is that we stand with you. Your black brothers and sisters will go to bat for you. They will risk their jobs for you. They will march on your behalf, and they will create a roar that cannot be ignored. I stand up. Thank you for your interest in my case, but this is something that I'd have to discuss with my lawyer, no matter what. What color skin does your lawyer have? Wallace interrupts. What difference does it make? I challenge. How can you ever expect to be treated well by white people if you're constantly picking them over for flaws? He smiles, as if he's heard this before. You've heard of Trayvon Martin, I assume. Of course I have. The boy's death hit me hard. Not just because he was about Edison's age, but because, like my son, he was an honor student who had been doing nothing wrong, except being black. Do you know that during that trial, the judge, the white judge, banned the term racial profiling from being used in the courtroom? Wallace says. She wanted to make sure that the jury knew the case was not about race, but about murder. His words punched through me. Arrows. They are almost verbatim what Kennedy told me about my case. Trayvon was a good kid, a smart boy. You are a respected nurse. The reason that judge didn't want to bring up race, the same reason your lawyer is skirting it like it's the plague, is because black people like you and Trayvon are supposed to be the exceptions. You are the very definition of when bad things happen to good people. Because that is the only way white gatekeepers can make excuses for their behavior. He leans forward, his mug clasped in his hands. But what if that's not the truth? What if you and Trayvon aren't the exceptions, but the rule? What if injustice is the standard? All I want is to do my job, live my life, raise my boy. I don't need your help. You may not need it, he says. But apparently there are a lot of people out there who want to help you just the same. I mentioned your case last week briefly on my show. He shifts, reaching into the inside breast pocket of his suit and pulling out a small manila envelope. Then he stands and passes it to me. Good luck, sister. I'll be praying for you. As soon as the door closes behind him, I open the seal and dump out the contents. Inside are bills. Tens, twenties, fifties. There are also dozens of checks written out to me from strangers. I read the addresses on them. Tulsa, Oklahoma. Chicago. South Bend. Olympia, Washington. At the bottom of the pile is Wallace Mercy's business card. I gather everything into the envelope, tuck it into an empty vase on a shelf in the living room, and then see it. My missing visor, resting on the cable box. It feels like a crossroads. I settle the visor on my head, grab my wallet and my coat, and head out the door to my shift. I keep my favorite picture of Wesley and me on the mantle of my house. We were at our wedding, and his cousin snapped it when we weren't looking. In the photo, we are standing in the lobby of the elegant hotel where we had our reception, the rental of which was Sam Hollowell's wedding gift to me. My arms are looped around Wesley's neck, and my head is turned. He is leaning in, his eyes closed, whispering something to me. I have tried so hard to remember what my handsome husband, breathtaking in his tuxedo, was saying. I'd like to believe it was, "You are the most beautiful thing I've ever seen," or "I can't wait to start our life together." But that is the stuff of novels and movies. And in reality, I'm pretty sure we were planning our escape from a room full of well-wishers so that I could pee. The reason I know this is because although I cannot remember the conversation that Wesley and I had when that photograph was taken, I do remember the one we had afterward. There was a line at the ladies' room off the main lobby, and Wesley gallantly volunteered to stand guard at the men's room so that no one would enter while I was inside. It took me a significant amount of time to maneuver my wedding gown and do my business, and when I finally made it out of the bathroom, a good 10 minutes had passed. Wesley was still outside the door, my sentry, but now he was holding a valet claim ticket. "What's that?" I asked. We didn't have a car then. We had taken public transport to our own wedding. Wesley shook his head, chuckling. "Some dude just walked up to me and asked me to bring his Mercedes around." We laughed and gave the ticket to the bellhop desk. We laughed because we were in love. Because when life is full of good things, it does not seem important if an old white guy sees a black man in a fancy hotel and naturally assumes he must work there. After a month of working at McDonald's, I begin to see the paradox between service and sanitary food preparation. Although all orders are supposed to be prepared in less than 50 seconds, most items on the menu take longer than that to cook. McNuggets and Filet-O-Fish fry for almost 4 minutes. Chicken selects take 6 minutes, and weighing in at the longest in the fry vat are crispy chicken breasts. 10-to-1 meat takes 39 seconds to cook. 4-to-1 meat takes 79 seconds. The grilled chicken is actually steamed while it cooks. Apple pie bakes for 12 minutes, cookies for 2. And yet, in spite of all this, we employees are supposed to have the customer walking out the door in 90 seconds. 50 for food prep, 40 for a meaningful interaction. The managers love me, because unlike most of the staff, I do not have to juggle class schedules with my shifts. After decades of working nights, I don't mind coming in at 3:45 a.m. to open grill, which takes a while to heat up before we unlock the doors at 5. Because of my flexibility, I'm usually given my favorite job, cashier. I like talking to the customers. I consider it a personal challenge to make them smile before they walk away from the counter. And after literally having women throw things at my head in the thick of labor, being berated for mayo instead of mustard really doesn't faze me. Most of our regulars come in the mornings. There are Marge and Walt, who wear identical yellow sweatsuits and walk 3 miles from their house, and then get matching hotcake meals with orange juice. There's Allegria, who's 93 and comes in once a week in her fur coat, no matter how warm it is outside, and eats an Egg McMuffin. No meat, no cheese, no muffin. There's Consuela, who gets 4 large iced coffees for all the girls at her salon. This morning, one of the homeless folks who pepper the streets of New Haven wanders in. Sometimes my manager will give them food, if it's about to be thrown out, like the fries that go unsold after 5 minutes. Sometimes they come in to warm up. Once we had a man pee in the bathroom sink. Today, the man who enters has long, tangled hair and a beard that reaches his belly. His stained T-shirt reads, "Namaste in bed," and there is dirt crusted underneath his fingernails. "Hello," I say. "Welcome to McDonald's. Can I take your order?" He stares at me, his eyes rheumy and blue.
"I want a song."
"I beg your pardon?"
"A song." His voice escalates. "I want a song."
My manager on duty, a tiny woman named Patsy, steps up to the counter. "Sir," she says, "you need to move along."
"I want a fucking song."
Patsy flushes. I'm calling the police. No, wait. I meet the man's eye and start crooning Bob Marley. I used to sing Three Little Birds to Edison as a lullaby every night. I'll probably remember the words till the day I die. The man stops screaming and shuffles out the door.